Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Washington Weekly Podcast on the UBS In The Now podcast channel. Joining us once again for the conversation, glad to welcome back Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Shane, once again, nice to have you here on the podcast. Thank you for dropping by and for spending some time today with our listeners.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to be back with you. Hope you're doing well.
Likewise, Shane. Thank you. And I know there are quite a few fluid topics that we will cover with our audience today, perhaps beginning with government funding. I know the past few days we have seen a lot of traction surrounding a government funding solution with the shutdown deadline on March 14th. We're recording on Thursday, so we're just hours away from that. Can you speak a bit to the terms, the contents of the bill we witnessed passed in the House earlier this week? It's currently in the Senate, so curious as to where that stands. And what are your overall thoughts on the prospects at this point for a shutdown?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Great question. You know, here we are talking just probably about 36 hours away from a potential shutdown. But I think in that time, we'll see the Senate move this government funding bill that has already passed the House. It passed the House on a very partisan vote. I think one Republican voted no and one Democrat voted yes. Other than that, you know, everyone else in their respective parties, you know, towed the party line. So the question is, you know, what happens in the Senate? And while we do think it's going to pass, you're seeing a lot of bravado that it may lead to a shutdown, but I think that bravado is positioning. I think Democrats will get a vote on an amendment to do a 30-day extension, and they'll try and use that as their outlet. And then when that fails, just enough Democrats will cross the aisle to ensure passage of this government funding bill. And so this government funding bill would fund government operations through the remainder of the fiscal year, which is through the end of September, which is, you know, obviously way behind schedule. You know, Congress historically tries to obviously get government funding bills done before the new fiscal year starts on October 1st. But, you know, here we are almost 6 months later, and Congress is still kind of trying to put the pieces together to finish this fiscal year's bill. This bill, you know, Republicans are trying to say it's a quote clean CR, which means basically you're funding government operations without, you know, riders, you know, whether it be something like fixing payments for physicians, or Democrats would have liked to have seen amendments to try and restrict Elon Musk and Doge and their activities. So things like of that nature are not on this bill. You know, overall, it does give, I think, a little bit additional money to defense funding. Also, I believe it increases funding for air traffic control priorities for the remainder of the fiscal year when compared to 2024 levels. So, you know, there are a few other items in it, but, you know, I think the important thing for us is, you know, no government shutdown, which, you know, is impactful. But I think we should, even if there is a government shutdown, we shouldn't let it kind of scare us, because the markets, you know, have seen government shutdowns before, and it's not a huge market mover from its outset. So I think, you know, we can hopefully get through this week, and then Congress can shift to other priorities.
Well, Shane, thank you for that update with respect to where we currently stand. Very helpful to hear some context with respect to market implications as well. Speaking of the markets, I know we have seen a lot of volatility in markets this week as investors have been digesting very fluid headlines surrounding tariffs, trade. We did see Canada and the European Union impose retaliatory measures against the U.S., this following the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum. I know there's a lot going on here. So where does this all stand, Shane? And can you highlight some of these retaliatory measures for us?
Yeah. And to your point, this is so fluid. I mean, I think we're just seeing President Trump threaten 200% tariffs on wine from Europe. And I think champagne would be included in that. So, you know, very fluid, a lot going on. And to your point, I think that's part of, you know, how this should be interpretive, is that this is going to be fluid and volatile for the next coming weeks, especially as we see we get closer to that April 2nd deadline, where President Trump has threatened reciprocal tariffs on a number of countries. So, and that is not fully defined. So I think, you know, it's kind of a bit of a moving target. And I think you'll see countries come in and try to start negotiating with the Trump administration and buy themselves some goodwill. So maybe some of those reciprocal tariffs don't go into place on April 2nd. But you're right. The Trump administration has raised tariffs on global steel and aluminum imports to 25%. And, you know, it seems like the administration is digging its heels in here, right? And I think that's some of what we're seeing in the marketplace right now, is that volatility being felt. And I think, you know, this thing will be a roller coaster ride for the next 4 years. There'll be times when this tariff talk is really heavy. And then when the tariff talk goes away, we shouldn't lose sight that it could come back at any moment, as tariffs to President Trump are his main tool at his side for any kind of negotiation. So, you know, even though an issue may not be related to tariffs, you know, he may seek to use tariffs as his tool to start engaging with a country on a separate topic. But also, you know, I think I left out that the EU announced retaliatory tariffs yesterday on $28 billion worth of goods from the U.S., such as motorbikes and alcohol. And so a lot going on here, and a lot for us to digest and continue talking about.
Definitely. Well, Shane, that was a very helpful inventory. I do want to stick with the White House for a few more moments. This was interesting. We did see reports this week about the White House exploring a reversal of the CHIPS Act. So I'm curious what the rationale would be behind that, and how likely would a reversal be?
Yeah, and this stems from President Trump's address to Congress, where, you know, he mentioned the CHIPS Act, and then I think he ad-libbed and talked about its repeal. And so I think this is kind of a outflow of that ad lib. I think the reality on the ground, though, is that we don't expect it to be repealed. You know, it was passed in a bipartisan manner with Republican support in both the House and Senate during President Biden's term. And, you know, I think some of those Republicans who did not even support it recognize that while it's not perfect, at the end of the day, this is really important to kind of the U.S. not being reliant on China for semiconductors, which are, you know, paramount to technology and, you know, therefore almost paramount to the future of technology and our country's economy. So I think, you know, while there is a number of Republicans who would be interested in repealing it because they don't, like President Trump, believe that it's needed, because you're seeing some of these investments already being made in the U.S. And, you know, I do pause and say that I think Republicans will balk at the end of the day, and there'll be enough opposition within the Republican Party to stop the repeal of the CHIPS Act.
Well, thank you, Shane, for that clarity on the CHIPS Act. Before we close out, if we turn to geopolitics, we, of course, cover the exchange in the Oval Office a couple of weeks ago involving Ukrainian President Zelensky, along with President Trump and Vice President Vance. As we're speaking today on March 13th, I understand that a team of U.S. officials have arrived in Russia to discuss a Ukraine ceasefire agreement. Do you have a sense for who is involved in these discussions? What might the terms of an agreement consist of? And is there a a status on that minerals agreement between the U.S. and Ukraine? Has that been revisited?
Yeah, you know, so Ukraine and U.S., you know, agreed to essentially a temporary 30-day ceasefire, right? And this did not, you know, have really any details for a longer, you know, resolution to the war between Ukraine and Russia. And, you know, I think the point is to try and pause fighting, allow for the real conversations to happen and hard conversations to happen that would actually start to negotiate a real truce. And, you know, what does Ukraine get out of agreeing to this 30-day ceasefire? Well, the U.S. Will resume flow of aid and intelligence sharing to Ukraine. So, you know, on the flip side, though, Russia does not see this as to their advantage. They see this as giving Ukraine 30-day reprieve and allowing to, you know, prepare for another wave of fighting. And the Kremlin has already signaled that they're not on board with this agreement. I think it was Putin's foreign policy advisor, Yuri Ashakov. So, you know, I would also note that Putin himself, I think, showed up to the Kursk region on Wednesday wearing fatigues, which is not a good sign. So I think, you know, this was a good first effort by President Trump to talk to Ukrainians about a peaceful solution. But right now it does not look optimistic that Russia will agree to this. But we'll see where it heads. But, you know, I don't see any huge opening light for optimism at this point. But as we have talked about previously, you know, sometimes, you know, small little efforts lead to the future, you know, progression. So we'll see if this brings something about. But right now, I don't think this is going to lead to a long-term peaceful settlement. So, you know, stay tuned for more.
Shane, thank you for helping us to manage expectations as we continue to monitor these negotiations. And thank you again, Shane, for dropping by today, keeping our listeners, our clients informed on a range of timely topics. I'm sure we'll cover many of these on our next conversation. So looking forward to that. Thank you again, Shane, for your time today.
Thank you, Dan. Always good to be with you.
Likewise. Thank you, Shane. Again, today we have been joined by Shane Lieberman, Senior Governmental Affairs Advisor with Governmental Affairs U.S. here at UBS. Before we close out, I do want to remind you, our listeners, especially our clients of UBS, please be sure to reference the latest Washington Weekly publication, which can now be located up on ubs.com/Washington Weekly. From UBS Studios, I'm Dan Cassidy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.